Good morning. And I figured I'd start with these shorts just to wake everybody up. So I got a running start. So there's this whole thing around natural user interface, this NUI, that it's one of these words. It's a real word because it has a Wikipedia page now, so it must be real. And it's one of these terms that I have a love-hate relationship with, because it actually has meaning to me, but it's one of these words that has, and the term is used so much for so many different things that it starts, the entropy gets so great that it almost means nothing. So I wanted to just talk a bit about it because it's trying to signal that there's a difference and a change from the graphic user interface that we've had since the mid-70s. But the question is, where does it go? And what does it mean? And how do we think about it? And if we're going to try and accelerate the innovation and the development from over this transition from the traditional status quo of the graphical user interface, how do we think about it? And so I wanted to start by saying, what's a way to look at it that might be different? And why not start with Marcel Proust if you want to think about where, how to look at things? And I love this line. This is the only true voyage of discovery is not to go to new places, but to have other eyes. And so in some sense, I want to talk about how my eyes see this and how might yours in the future. And I want to frame this in a sense of saying that maybe like a lot of designers, I have a bad habit of being a collector. For about 30 odd years, I've been collecting mice and joysticks and all kinds of gadgets, and you'll see some of them today. But in its largely, I think it's because I want to be a historian when I grow up, but also I just don't know how to throw things away. But this is a museum exhibit of some of my collection, and if you're at SIGCHI this year, you'll see some more of it. And I'm just showing you this by way of prefacing how I think about innovation and by follow-on, how I think about a very important aspect of design, which is kind of different than the flashbulb going off in the brain, genius, inventor, person alone in the room and just having this great idea and changing the world. That's simply, in my experience, not how it works. And as any good creative person, I stole everything I have ever thought of, just like Thomas Alva Edison. And here I just took the long tail from Chris Anderson and just flipped it around the other way and invented a whole new theory based on his ideas, just looked at from the other direction. And this is what I call the long nose of innovation. Now, there's only two characters in literature that have long noses. In particular, there's Pinocchio, who was a liar, so I don't want it to be a Pinocchio theory. But then there's Cyrano de Bergerac, which is sort of like the great lover. So this is something maybe you can turn to love. And the thing about the long nose is that it basically says that from the inception of an idea to the time it reaches maturity, which is a billion-dollar industry, that's how I'm just going to arbitrarily define maturity, is that it takes at least 20 years. And that most of it is way down low, and then it hockey sticks up. That's a Canadian reference to remind you that I'm Canadian. Now, right off the bat, there's something really important here. Because it says if it takes 20 years, and I have very sound data that for every technology in information technology and telecommunications, this is true. The mouse took 30 years, invented in 65, and it wasn't until 1995 that it became ubiquitous. But even if you move back to 84 when the Macintosh came out, we've already got in the 20 years. That says that any idea that's going to reach $1 billion in the next 10 years is already 10 years old. And if you take nothing else from this talk, instead of going around trying to come up with the next great idea, realize the next great idea has been sitting on the ground right in front of you for 10 years already. And it completely changes your approach. And if you think at Microsoft, when the iPhone came out, everybody's sitting there saying, oh, wow, there's nothing new here. That's true. There's nothing new, and everything's different. And that's not a paradox. And so when somebody says, we've tried that, it's been done before, it's failed, or that's already been done, say, that's why it's a good idea. That's not a reason to excuse it, or at least it's not a reason to dismiss it outright. It still may be a terrible idea. But it really changes how you think about design. It really changes how you think about innovation. And the reason this is interesting is because most of the lifespan is 20 years. The ideas are below the radar. That doesn't mean they're not there. It just means if you don't go like a prospector and know how to search for them with the right Geiger counter, the right tools, that you won't see them. You have to have other eyes. But if you don't know this theory and you don't approach it this way, you won't think to ask yourself, what are the right tools? Where should I look? Where is the gold buried? And how do I prospect for it? How will I recognize it when I see it? And it's a really important thing. And I'll give you a really good case study that I've been directly involved with. We were doing multi-touch in 1984. Now, 1984 is an important year. That's the same year the Macintosh was first released. Multi-touch was being done then, and we published in 1985. It was in the public domain for anybody who knew how to read a conference proceedings. Demonstrated and visible, and not just for my group. But it took until 2007 before the majority of people, even in the technology sector, had ever heard of it. And that was with the launch of Microsoft Surface and the Apple iPhone. And all of a sudden, there's this hot new thing. It's the greatest thing in the world. Well, for some of us, it wasn't a hot new thing. It's something we'd done and published and got on with our lives. And it's still not up at the top of the curve. And what I'm saying is pick almost anything that you know about, you're the expert in, and I bet you'll say the same thing's true. The things you really know about and you've been tracking. Sue, is there anything, I'm 61, is there anything here today that you didn't know about 10 years ago that's having a huge impact? That doesn't mean you understood what it meant. It doesn't mean you knew how to make it into a billion-dollar industry. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. I'd be a billionaire. I'd own Microsoft, right? But that doesn't mean I didn't know about it. It just means I'm an idiot in terms of I should stay in research and not be running a business strategy, right? But the point is that it's if you think about it, we already knew this, but we hadn't seen it with the eyes that maybe this conceptual model helps to bring it about. But it basically says that there's these multiple phases where you have the invention. This is why we have Microsoft Research. That's what my job is, to be at the tip of the nose. The middle part is what live labs and office labs and so on are about. It's the refinement and augmentation, advanced development. Now the product groups are here towards the base of the nose, generally speaking. There's exceptions, obviously, all along. So I want to just work around this theme of touch to try and put some meat on the bone here to talk about how some of this, we might think about this, because it's nice to arm wave, but let's dive into some specifics. If you go back on the web and you just do a search, the URL is there, but if you just do a search on Computer Chronicles 1990 and put in the word touch, you'll find this was a TV series that was on US television, but these are all archived online. You'll see all of these from MicroTouch and Eel Graphics, this is 20 years ago, just talking about how wonderful touch is. And the most interesting thing about it in this world where everybody's talking about NUI, natural user interface, it's a great new thing, is that's exactly the term that they were using to describe these touch screens and these touch technologies back in way, way back in 1990. That still seems to me pretty recent. But that's just because I'm old. Now, there are things that are pretty interesting about touch. And it has all kinds of advantages. And this falls into this part, one of the most, it's starting to be something that actually, you know, you say things often enough, they start to get traction. You start to see people actually quote me on this one now because it for stating something obvious, but apparently it needs to be, takes a while for people to find out it's obvious. But it's just everything's best for something and worst for something else. And we're looking at design and we're looking at technologies and appropriate technologies. The trick is, for every technology to say, why is it best, why is it worse, for whom, for what, for where, why. And so when you have this sort of thing about, I'm saying the Proustian sense of seeing things through different eyes, are there techniques that we can use that help us see with other eyes? One is having the conceptual model to say it's there. If you can't see it because you're blind, get a pair of glasses. What are the glasses that let you have this kind of vision? But the other part is there's basic questions you can always ask yourself. And exercises, behaviors. So the one behavior I would say is this. If you're ever in a group, design, engineering, of anything, when somebody comes in and says, here, they're coming in to advocate for their great idea. And by the way, it might be a really good idea. My perspective with my group is I will say, why does it suck? Why is it horrible? And if they are not as articulate as to when it will fail, when it should not be used, who it should not be used for, or what contexts, then they haven't done their homework. If you do not understand the idea, full 360, if everything's best for something and worst for something else, anybody advocating that thing who cannot articulate the full circle of best and worst and in between, they don't understand it. And it doesn't mean they're a bad person. It just says, as a manager, as a team member, say, either go back and do your homework and then come back when you've actually understand what you're trying to advocate before you try to convince us to commit to an idea that you haven't thought through, or let's as a group have that conversation. And by the way, if it's your idea where you're actually happy that the team is going to do that, to say when, because they're not tearing your idea apart, they're trying to help understand it. And that social dynamic of it, I'm not criticizing your idea, I'm trying to understand your idea, and we know that it's worse for something. Now, if you have that attitude, you get rid of these idiots who think, and this is unfortunately has been too often my experience, a thing of very clever engineers and very clever people, not just engineers, which means a lot of people at Microsoft, is the way you show how clever you are is by being able to shoot down every single idea. It won't work because of X. That proves I'm the hottest person in the world. I understand things, man. I can tell you what's wrong with every idea. Well, for those people is, before you reject the idea because of that, you play the inverse game. Say, I'm not going to reject this idea just because you can shoot it down unless you likewise can say when it is the best idea. Right? You got to walk on both sides of the street. And these are simple behaviors that completely change the group dynamics in terms of how we do whatever decision, whether it's an engineering decision, a business decision, or a design decision. Here, the neat things about touch is that they're, unlike mice, there's no mechanical parts. They can be completely, cookie-proof, Coca-Cola-proof, and so on and so forth. They are beautiful for places that have to be pristine clean, like in hospital operating rooms, or which are really filthy dirty, where you can just clean them, where other input devices aren't, for example. But there's a history here that's really interesting. What a lot of people don't understand is that as long ago as 1972, in the cornfields of Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, that in kindergarten to grade 12 classrooms, there were these lovely portable devices called Play-Doh. By the way, these are plasma displays. Play-Doh invented the plasma display at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and touchscreens. They didn't invent them. They were the first to widely deploy them. But already in classrooms, they were delivering children's education content. This is the beginning of computer-aided instruction, as early as 1972 using touchscreens on plasma displays. All of a sudden, some of the stuff we're doing today doesn't seem quite as cool, right? This is the tip of the nose. But be very clear, CDC, Controlled Data Corporation, had this stuff commercialized by 74, 75. And most of us who are talking about how great touch is have never heard of it. And it's really interesting. I know it because I'm old, but it doesn't matter. It's recent history. And supposedly we have information technologies, therefore we should, in fact, we all have the resources to be informed. This is some really interesting work from 1978 from Chris Herrett and I can't remember his first name, Weizenzottel. They had a touch screen at MIT out of the Media Lab, which not only could sense touch, but it could sense the force of touch, but also the torque by the amount of twist, and even the shear in two dimensions. So if I touched and put a force upwards or horizontal or diagonal. Because basically this touch screen was mounted on strain gauges. Now here's the thing that tells us about why our profession in computer science and our reviewing processes and everything is bankrupt. That came out of what was called the Architecture Machine Group that grew into the Media Lab at MIT. It was published in SIGGRAPH in 1978 in the SIGGRAPH proceedings. Then in the late 1990s, another student from the Media Lab published exactly the same paper in exactly the same conference using a different way of implementing it, and none of the reviewers caught it, much less the conference, and I apparently was the only one, and sort of said, by the way, have you read this paper? No. Which means that none of her advisors, because it was a thesis work, even knew the work of their own, the history of their own laboratory. And that's frightening. Because my view is, whereas most people are saying how fast technologies are moving, I think it's just the opposite. I can't believe how slowly they're moving. I always used to think this was because the name Rip Van Winkle is a Dutch name, but it's actually an American story. But it's a story of this guy who went to sleep and woke up about 40 years later. But basically, if somebody went to sleep having a driver's license in 1984, having used a Macintosh, and woke up today, they'd be able to drive today's computers just as well as they can drive today's cars. They'd be more technologically advanced, but in many ways, there's been no progress whatsoever in the conceptual model of how we interact with computers. The mouse, the keyboard, the graphics interface, the icons, the windows, scrolling, all of those things have not changed. So tell me again how fast technology is moving. For me, it's an embarrassment. But that's my job, to be embarrassed. The first graphical workstation with Windows, the PERC workstation, which came on the market before the Xerox Star, the PERC, it had a touchpad. That's what it shipped with. The Apollo workstation, this is a good example here. The Apollo workstation was one of the first workstations had a touchpad, and the implementation was so bad, and so it was such a success, you know, such a popular machine, that you had a very large number of potential users exposed to touchpads and convinced that they didn't work because of incompetence of the people who implemented them. And so the entire technology was tainted because of simply incompetent engineering and design. And this is one of the other parts that's really interesting, is that we tried it, it didn't work, it's a failure, we're going to dismiss it. And one of the things, the next part is, this isn't a failure. It was one of the worst pieces of HCI and user experience I've ever seen. It wasn't a failure. No. It was a really expensive education for which somebody else paid the tuition. And the only question is, I can benefit from that if I just simply read it. And so other people's failures are some of the most profitable places to mine for good ideas if you take a different approach to doing the analysis. I'm not going to go through it, but if you people always study Apple's successes, study their failures. The G4 Cube, the Bondo Blue iMac, the hockey puck mouse that came with that. Nobody remembers it was a failure. There's failure after failure after failure. And it's really important to understand how companies deal with those failures, which is, and by the way, Apple hasn't succeeded despite their failures. They have succeeded because of their failures. And people who only study what they did well are getting it wrong. They're missing the whole point. And by the way, that's true with any company that's a worthy competitor, that's worthy of studying. Multi-touch, before we were even doing our work in 1981, existed. It just didn't exist in the HCI field. They were building tactile sensors, basically for robotics. So for robotics, you could actually sense things when you grasp. So that was some of the first work. This is a touch keyboard that was made it's one of the things in my collection. This is some stuff from Myron Kruger. If everybody's talking about the pinch to zoom, well, this is from 1983. Okay, watch this video. And what he's doing this with video capture, But he's capturing the silhouette, removing the background from his finger with a video camera, real-time video analysis, and then superimposing graphics that's between the points. So he's doing image recognition of the hand, taking the silhouette, finding the fingers, the thumb and the fingers, and then being able to make the position and the size of that ball track the hand. This is a year before the Macintosh came out, and this isn't even a computer scientist. He's an artist. And tell me again that pinch to zoom is a new idea. Here he's doing lines, and he's even been able to recognize the two fingers, come up and sense the menu, and then be able to pass the line from two fingers to another finger and still be able to rubber band lines. By the way, these are unlike any rubber band line that any of us have used in a commercial system, because unlike the elastic bands in the real world, which you can pull from either end, virtually every rubber band you have on your Macintosh or your PC is nailed down at one end, and you can only pull from one end. In my world, that's a catapult. That's not an elastic band. Right? And there, you can hurt yourself with those things. And I would have thought that a $2,000 computer would at least do rubber bands better than a less than one kroner elastic band, right? We have a ways to go. It's embarrassing. I collect these things. This is a watch. It's a very cool watch. I'll pass it around. It's right here. And this watch has on it a touchscreen. Now, if you get it in your hands, you can just push the bottom left button here. And even though it looks like an analog watch, it has a touchscreen. The entire crystal is a touchscreen. And if I draw a 1, the calculator, it enters a 1. If I do a 7, it gives me a 7. If I draw a plus sign, it gives me a plus sign, if I do it right. And then if I do a 3, I get a 3. And if I draw the equal sign, it gives me the equal sign. I write on the surface with my finger. Now, I want you to compare it to this other. I'll show you the others in a minute. But here's the point. This watch with a touchscreen was sold commercially. There's the advertisement right there. You can see it for yourself. What does it say? It's $99.95 anyhow. Under $100 US in 1984. Character recognition, touchscreen, wristwatch, consumer electronics, 1984. What else happened in 1984? I already told you. That's the year the Macintosh was released. So instead of being dazzled by today's smartphones with touch, with this right in front of you, I'm going to pass it around so you can play with it, but I expect it back. It's not, wow, how cool are we doing today with our smartphones? It is, what the hell have we been doing for the last 25 years? Right? Right? Play with it. And if you want to clear it, just hit the bottom left button a couple times, and it'll say C-A-L. And it's not the world's greatest character recognizer, but it's okay. By the way, 25 years, I think if you'll find that if you multiply that by 12, which is how many months there's been, and you divide it by 18, which is one Moore's law, you'll find that's 17 Moore's laws ago. Anybody know what 2 to the 17th is? My recollection is true. It's somewhere around 136,480 times. The chip inside that watch, this chip of the same size was around today, it would have over 130,000 times the compute power that they had available to do that in 1984. More than 130,000. Think about it. If that watch didn't exist, Rick Rashid and Microsoft Research would fund me to do it. I could still get funding to do that watch if it didn't exist. Furthermore, with a fraction of the size of the chip that's in there, I could add Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, and probably a gigabyte of RAM, and still sell it for less money. And if I can't, I'm a wimp, you know, or incompetent, right? And what as an industry? This isn't a Microsoft bashing, this is an industry bashing session, right? We have to be frustrated. Our job is to be frustrated. That makes us hungry, that makes us ambitious, that makes us not settle for less. Where do you set the bar? Your performance is based on where you set the bar. As a company, the most important thing we have to do, but even as individual designers, with your students like from Malmo or whatever, they're here, it's where you set the bar. What are the standards? And if you say our competitors out there today are adequate or appropriate standards, I think you're aiming way, way too low. And I can prove it, because if they could do that in 1984, we can do better than we can do it today. Because if they could do it, that means we can do it. Or we probably are in the wrong business. This is just a calculator that I have as well that does exactly the same thing. I collect these things as they come out. My job is to scout and prospect. But this is the PF8000, which is really, really cool. These are the other watches. I have a number of watches. I'll pass this one around. I must have left one at home. No, I didn't. This is the one that everybody is used to, that has a million buttons on it. Okay? It's a calculator, same year. You've seen one of these, but by the way, these are all Casios, so you can all just push the bottom left button and that'll put them in calculator mode. Now, I also have this one that came out in 1984. I have a couple of these. So this is the fancy one with the metal. I wanted it to look more like the one. This also has a full touch screen. And you can see it has the same numerical keypad on it through the calculator. Now I have this other one. This is a modern Tissot. This one actually I didn't charge to Microsoft because it's too cool of a watch and it's too expensive. So I figured I could get through expensing this one. But this also has a touch screen, and the thing you do with this is you just hold in the minute hand, and then if you touch it here, the hands go around. It actually turns out to be a compass. So it's the computer display isn't the LCD in it. It's actually the hand. So you have a mechanical computer display. So it completely messes with your mind. But you can play with that one, too. I really want these back. The doors are locked. But there's a really important point here. First of all, we got three calculator watches. 1, 2, 3. They're all from Casio. They're all from 1984. Two have touch screens. One doesn't. Now, let's pretend they all have the same black or the same metal armbands. Here's the standard intelligence question, because everybody has done these intelligence tests where they give you three things, and you have to say which one doesn't belong, which is the outlier. So, calculator watch number A, touchscreen character recognition. B, numerical keypad, touchscreen, calculator. D, calculator, mechanical buttons, mechanical keypad. Of those three, which does not belong? Which is the outlier? Yes?
A.
A is the outlier. Who agrees with A? Okay. All right. Who thinks B is the outlier? Who thinks this is the outlier? I'm in an engineering center. Okay. The important thing when you have people like me asking questions like that, the correct answer is just say, that's a bogus question. Okay? Because you know I'm setting you up. And both are right, but now you have to say, remember this Proust expression, see the world through different eyes. Which eyes are you viewing the world from? If you chose this, you're viewing the world from a technocentric perspective, because from a technocentric perspective, hardware technology, by the way, this is the same. This is the outlier. It doesn't have a touchscreen. These two have touchscreens. I'm going to take the human-centric perspective. And let me ask you if you change your mind for the people who chose D. Which two of those three calculator watches could share the same documentation? With minor changes. There's no question. B&D, right? The conceptual model transcends the technology that delivers that conceptual model. It doesn't matter if it's mechanical keys. It does matter from the fat finger problem. But it doesn't matter that it's mechanical keys or virtual soft keys. The conceptual model, if you know how to use this one and you know how to use that one, you can use either or this one or that one, they help you work each other. Because I've told you that all of them go into calculator mode by pushing the button on the bottom left side. This one and that one, if you know how to use that, you know how to use that. Same conceptual model. They're the same user interface from a conceptual perspective, but at the pragmatic level, it's different. Just the delivery technology. It's really important. So the conceptual model transcends touch. The UI isn't in the its touchiness. And by the way, this is touch, for pity's sakes. I'm touching those bloody buttons. Right? Now, let's move to the other three, these three touch watches. What I want to say about those three touch watches is knowing how to use any one of them buys you exactly zero in terms of knowing how to use the other two. The conceptual model and the purpose and function of each of those three things, even if I tell you that they're touch interfaces, they buy you nothing. Knowing how to use any two of those buys you exactly nothing in terms of how to use the third one. Which leads me to say, anybody who describes an interface as a touch interface is unqualified to comment on the topic. Because the granularity of analysis is on the technology and in a way that is so broad that it's meaningless, unless we're talking about specific technologies. And by the way, even if they talk about touch technologies, I want to know what kind of touch technologies, because it makes a huge amount of difference. It's really popular to say the devil's in the detail. That's a very recent, pessimistic introduction into the language. Flaubert said it much better. God is in the detail. If we understand things at a fine enough level of detail, then we're off to the races. We can start to make meaningful distinctions that really do the things we see some of our competitors doing and what we do in our best work. But the key thing is, all of those are there to buy. And if you think, I didn't have to build anything, but for that whole thing, $2,000 on eBay. Everything there's from eBay. eBay is it's the lowest cost prototyping tool you have. I like Sketchflow, but that beats it for hardware. Because all of those things work at a product level. And I can hand them around so you can experience them. And then we have something, so it gets rid of all these arguments. This is better. No, try it. Now tell me which is better. Okay? Because we have concrete manifestations of the concepts. Here's some old stuff that's kind of fun.
With this example, we can demonstrate how the tablet can sense position as well as degree of touch. We've hooked it up to a sound, and so we've got a high, pure sound here, pitch going down as I descend, and richness with X, and degree controlling volume. And I can finger paint. Often, when we want to use the tablet surface to emulate a number of different virtual devices, it's useful to use a physical template laid over top of the tablet. Here I have five virtual potentiometers defined by their cutouts as well as a number of buttons. By attaching it to the tablet surface, I now have an operating console for a particular simulation. In this case, it's a small sound synthesizer, which I can turn on an oscillator. I can now adjust its volume and adjust its pitch and its spectral richness. As you can see, the three different controls affect three completely different parameters. I can add a second oscillator, raise its volume, change its richness, bring the pitch down, and even add a third oscillator, and I can shut them all off. What we have is an operating console done on a single physical device, which is reconfigurable depending on what template I have. And it saves going through all of the mechanical efforts to construct the analogous or the equivalent device, such as this one here, where I have likewise some single dimensional sliders and some button devices.
So there's a really important thing here. The reason I showed you this video is A, to say I really did have hair, and B, I wasn't lying when I said we were doing this in 1984. And the other part was is to say, there's a really big difference between touch tablets and touch screens. But the interesting thing about that template is that it gives you tactile feedback, like the frets on a guitar, or so you can do heads-up control without having to build anything. In essence, what you're doing is building a window manager that carves up a single physical input surface into a number of virtual devices in exactly the same way that a window manager on a screen carves up a single display into a number of virtual displays. But it lets you do heads up. So my hands can be here, like on a mixing console, so I can sort of touch type in the same, and my eyes can be focused on the thing that I'm supposed to be looking at. Now there's a really important tie-in there about this notion about eyes free versus eyes demanding. And one of the things about smartphones, whether it's a Windows phone or from any of our competitors, Symbian or Apple or whatever, try and SMS without looking. Now, I know this in the UK, and this isn't a sexist comment, it's just my observation, that every 12-year-old girl in England can text with a mechanical key under the table in school while talking to the teacher and answering an algebra question. You can't do that on a touch phone. And all of a sudden say, hey, gee, this is the age of Twitter and texting, and all of a sudden I have to use two hands pretty much and be like that? Well, just a minute. What if you had a touch thing we could enter text without looking? Could that work? Well, actually, the Casio AT550 that's going around the room right now, that watch, that's the whole deal. You hold rank of your thumb there, and within that screen, it's within the biomechanical acuity to enter those characters and draw without looking, especially if you use graffiti, if you've used a Palm Pilot. So all of a sudden, since 1984, we've had a technological solution that would enable us on a touch screen to enter text without looking. So that I can write down your phone number while looking at you. I can be watching the slides and taking quick notes. I can be sending you a message, what is the answer to question 3, without the teacher seeing me. I'm not sure that's the best solution. But the answer and the proof that I can give to somebody to try is right there on eBay. Actually, it's going to be really hard for you to find that. If you can find one of those watches for under $2,000, buy one instantly. It took me over 10 years to find a replacement for my first one. It's the rare one. We talked about big displays, big plasma displays. This is a honking big plasma display with a touchscreen secondary display, a soft console. And this is I shot the bottom right-hand image at SIGGRAPH. I didn't shoot the top one, but it's the same device. That's from 1986. Plasma panels of that size were commercially available in 1986. They were monochrome. And there were touch screens that were associated with them. It's pretty interesting. All the stuff's been lost. My kids used to sort of say, Dad, how come you go all around the world talking about this stuff? This is in the 80s. And I said, well, because I'm the genius who discovered people have two hands. I said, Dad, everybody knows that. I said, apparently not, because I don't have my jacket on, because the graphic user interface was designed for Napoleon Bonaparte, right? You can shove your everything like that, right? Just work like so. And the only thing you need two hands for is to type. Well, that's the one thing I can do with a pen with one hand. And, you know, most of us have two hands. And by the way, this isn't a poor approximation of that hand. It's just as specialized, but for a different type of task. And I'm going to show you that. But we were trying to understand these things and how do we make use of these technologies. But just to go quickly, 1986, Casio already had a little pocket organizer that had a pen input as well as had a capacitive touchscreen. You could use a pen or touch. You could do quick sketches on it. By the way, How many of you still carry on post-it notes to do quick drawings or stuff like that? Because you can, or a notebook, because, or a small, I do, because on a smartphone, now that we've gotten rid of styluses, because we know, marketing people told us, it must be true, right? That you're not, if it doesn't have touch, it's useless and nobody wants a stylus anymore, which means you can no longer take notes or draw or annotate. What's with that? Okay, but obviously they never had a decent pen-based thing. Paul McAvity at CMU made a touch screen where he could sense not only where you're touching and not only do multi-touch, but he could even sense the angle with which you came in. So you could actually get basically point in 3D space and so on and so forth. It was very cool. By 1992 to 94, at my lab, we made a drafting table-sized table. This is Hiroshi Ishii was working with me at that time. And it's the camera above is sensing his hand in position so that, and sensing the features here. This is just a rip off of Myron Kruger's stuff. I'd seen his work, and so we just tried to copy it here. So the stylus is used in the right hand for the fine drawing, which is what you do with, but the holding and manipulating was done with a non-dominant hand, just where you grab things on the surface and move them around. This is a rear projection table. This is 1992. Okay, I'm going to tell you about smartphones. See, smartphones are really cool. They're hot. Everybody wants one. Everybody's going to, actually, your Microsoft employees, if you are, you're going to get one. Is that true in Europe as well? Yeah, good, okay. So I'm going to describe a smartphone, okay? This is a smartphone. It's a really cool phone. It only has three buttons, on, off, and volume control. It's, the whole front of it is a touch screen. And the whole UI is just icons that you touch. And so if you want to dial, you bring up the whole icons look like a telephone keypad. And if you're going to go through your address book, you go through that. And you launch applications by just touching the icons and that. Now, does that conjure up an image of any product that any of you know about? What am I describing? Come on. You're allowed to say it, even though it's a Microsoft site. What? iPhone. I saw people lip iPhone. Jeez, what a bunch of wusses. You don't have to say that because it's Apple isn't a competitor that scooped us on this. Now, is everybody sick and tired of reading press about how brilliant the iPhone was? I just want to let you know the caliber of journalism on these matters. Let me introduce you. I own two of these. This is the world's first smartphone. It is called the Simon. It was developed jointly by IBM and Bell South and was announced and shown, demonstrated in 1993. I repeat, 1993, and yes, it had an on-off button and a volume control, and that's all it had. The entire front of it was a touchscreen. And it still works. And the UI, oh, here's the screen. These are some screenshots from mine. These are really off of mine. I took these pictures. There's the numerical keypad for dialing. This is the application. So yes, it has a clock, a timer, it's got an agenda, it's got email. It doesn't have a web browser. That's the problem with it. Now, it wasn't a problem, though, because if you happen to remember, the web didn't exist in 1993. That's how old this phone is. And by the way, Jonathan Ive, who designed the iPhone, the VP of design for Apple, he knew about this for sure, because what nobody mentions in the press about him is that he also designed the Newton. Which, by the way, the iPhone is the Mark II Newton. They just added a phone and added color and made it thinner. If, by the way, the minute I saw an iPhone, I sent a fake press release to that effect to Bill G and the senior exec. Because it's true. Just get over it, right? We'll skip that this other time. Graffiti is really important. It still is. It's called Block Recognizer on Microsoft phones. There's all kinds of shorthand that can happen. So if you're working on a phone, if you actually work, and this is stuff that we did as well, is that instead of having to go when you're texting to the shift to get uppercase, if you just touch and do a stroke up on the key, that's how you should. By the way, every Microsoft up until 6.5, all Microsoft soft keyboards on pen and touch-based phones already have that feature. You just don't know about it. And by the way, space, you just draw a horizontal stroke anywhere on the keyboard. Backspace, draw a horizontal stroke the other way. So all of a sudden, the speed of entry goes up. these types of shorthand, you have to really think about writing systems and understand these things to get really effective input. Now, I'm telling you this because partially this is an engineering development center. Partially I'm trying to say, this is why you need people like me whose job it is to understand the technology and the history of design and its implications on user experience at the same level of experience and depth that you have on engineering. Because you can't expect me to be a good engineer at that level if I'm spending my time here any more than I can expect you, if you're doing your job as an engineer, to know this. Each of us have essential skills, but neither of our skills are sufficient. But if we actually couple this and bring these insights together in our products, we can do spectacular stuff. Casio, this, by the way, this is the one thing, if you find one, get one of these on eBay. It's the Scion Series 5. People who, is anybody here old enough to have had one? Okay, is it true that you are as passionate, maybe even still today, about that as people are about their iPhones? If anybody has one, bring it in and let your group play with it. Because from a mechanical engineering, one of the things about it was made out of metal. It had a full-size keyboard. You could touch type on it, this tiny little thing. But the neat thing was, mechanically, when it opened up, it slid in the back because it had a touch screen, so that when you hit the touch screen, unlike laptops, the screen wasn't going boing, 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 boing like that. It actually was rigid because they really understood the industrial design. It was a beautiful piece of design. If you don't have one, or nobody in your group has one to bring in, order one, because all of these things, just have them around the studio so that everybody has them in their collective experience. And so it helps you give a shorthand. This is something called a portfolio wall. How are we doing for time? We're getting running down here, aren't we? No, we're actually a little bit okay. I'm going to just quickly do a quick demo of this. He says, hopefully. And this is something we released as a product, and it's just an electronic whiteboard, or a cork board, if you will. And so let's just look at this. This is my mouse collection. And the key thing about this is, I'll just use the touch screen on my laptop. So you just can touch any image, and it comes up full size. And then I can brush stroke it left and right to go from image to image and image through the sequence. I can stroke diagonally up to the right and bring up my pens and pick up a pen, and now I can draw and annotate. I can then shrink, close that, and go back to there and pull up, and I can pull up different tabs. What I'm trying to say here is that this stroke back and forth to advance images and to navigate, to bring up your photo browser, and so you can view them in slide sort of stuff, but even the ability to annotate and have all that under touch control, was shipping commercially by 1999. Again, that's when this was done. And the point is that there's all kinds of body of experience here that we can bring to inform our designs. I've got to find back where we were. So now I want to just wrap up with a couple things to say. I've been talking about touch. I talked a little bit about two hands. And I've tried to say that you can't just talk about touch. It's far richer than that. But the problem is, why this stuff is so complicated and hard to get right is because of the combinatorics. Because touch in itself isn't adequate. I mentioned earlier about some of this early work about we have two hands. They're specialized for different things. I'll do this really quickly. Who knows why women's shirt buttons are wrong? This is not a sexist remark. Women, your buttons are wrong. And there's a really good reason for it. You know, don't you?
I heard a variation of it.
Right. It's because of Yves Guillard's theory of the kinematic chain for bimanual asymmetric action. You knew that, right? Just right off the bat. Here's what it says. Here are the rules about bimanual action. I'm going to speak about this from the right-handed perspective. Here are the rules. This is symmetric action. Everything else is asymmetric bimanual action if it's two-handed. Non-dominant hand moves first. Rule number one. Rule number two. Non-dominant hand sets the location for the activity. Rule number three, which is pretty obvious, dominant hand follows. Rule number four, dominant hand does the fine motor action in the location where the non-dominant hand is located. That is how God wired us. If you do not understand the physiology, psychology, and the kinesiology of that, you will never get two-handed input right. These are highly specialized instruments. Now, if you're left-handed, you're a little bit weird because you've adapted to a lifetime of living in a right-handed world, and therefore your brain literally is wired slightly differently. But it's okay. Buttoning up, okay? I usually have a jacket on. Non-dominant hand grabs the moves first, grabs the buttonhole, holds the buttonhole in position. Dominant hand follows, grabs the button, moves the button to the buttonhole, and does the fine manipulation. By the way, threading a needle is exactly the same motor action. Start doing an inventory for all bimanual tasks. Now, and you'll see that this pattern repeats. There are a few exceptions. Ask yourself why, and you'll get even more understanding. The reason women's buttons are back to front is because when buttons were invented, they were expensive. The only people who could afford them were rich women. And rich women didn't dress themselves. They had a dresser. And therefore, the buttons are oriented, they are correct for the person dressing them and undressing them, which was not themselves, to the delight of men ever since. And that was a sexist comment. But the point there is, that's why women's buttons are that way. It's a legacy from that period when those traditions were started. It's really, and it's fantastic learning that sort of stuff. And there's tons of examples. There's other ones about why the spirals and castles go a particular way. But I'll leave that one out. You can take that knowledge and apply it. So I'm going to show you something. We have this thing called advanced, incubation group out of Microsoft Research and Craig Mundy's organization. So they did this thing called Gustav. So let me just jump into Gustav. And it's a paint program. So we've seen paint programs before. So I can bring in a paint, and there's some paint. I can come in with my hand, and I can pinch and zoom. And rotate at the same time. So you can actually start to see that they're actually doing 3D paint. This paint has actually depth and texture, and if I move the lights, you'd actually see the shadows change. I can come to the palette and I can pick a different color, and I can bring that in and paint here. I can come and I can smudge with my finger, with the same hand. See, I'm smudging the paint, and it really is blending the paint because it's actually modeling the physics of the paint. Okay? This is really understanding the materials. There's some pretty complex math going on here. What's really cool about it, well, I can change the paper and get the textures, but watch. Lots of companies, including Microsoft and Tablet PC, talk about pen and touch. Wrong from Boolean algebra perspective. It's pen exclusive or touch. You can touch or you can use pen. Watch. I'm painting, I'm grabbing, I'm moving the page and holding the brush still. That I can paint by moving the page under the pencil, the pen. It's stupid to do that. But the fact I can use the two in parallel, sense what is touch, and I can sense the difference between the touch which is scaling or rotating versus the touch that is smudging, even though it's and from the hand from the pen. I'm just showing you some stuff that sort of says, wow, if you understand Yves Guillard's kinematic chain model of the Immanuel asymmetric action, you might actually be able to use this bloody stuff in a way that actually fits the way people are wired and the way they function through the skills they've acquired from a lifetime of living in the everyday world. And if you don't understand Guillard's theory, good luck to you. I hope you work for the competition. Right? And what I'm trying to make the point here is, I'm running Windows 7 on a standard over-the-counter HP tablet PC, but with a special driver and some pretty cool software, but it's running. This is an existence proof. But, and by the way, this is great if you're a painter. You notice that that's not a great painting. It doesn't matter that I have three doctorates. I still can't paint. My wife is a professional painter. She can. Whether you can use this well or not is not a function of your how many degrees in computer science you have. It's how well you can paint. And the solutions are painter-specific. And until we start to design products which have this same level of specificity and optimization for the sensory, motor, and cognitive and social skills of our target customers, they're as good for medicine or business as this is for painters, then we fail. If we understand this by this point and then work in other point solutions for other professions and domains where we have products and we bring the same excellence, we will find that just like this paint program, it's useless for doing your income tax. It's useless for CRM, which is why it's so powerful. It's by what it doesn't try to do, because we know what it does and what it's, remember what I said, what does it suck for? What is it spectacular for? Who's it intended for? Do they care that it can't be, okay? Artists don't make enough money to pay taxes, so it doesn't have to do taxes, right? All right, so wrapping up. All we've been doing is dancing around a bunch of different things that help us understand how we might rethink these technologies. And I like memories, I like history, and so I want to just do a couple things now, because mobile is a big deal. This is a screenshot of my phone. Here's my phone. I just bought a new phone. My new phone cost me $28,000. That's my new phone. So say, that's not a phone, that's a car. Well, no, it's not. I guess it is. It's actually my most expensive PC, because 30% of the cost of that vehicle is the computer systems in it. Any modern car today, 30% of the cost of the vehicle. This one happens to have sync in it. When I take this very same phone and put it in the car, it becomes a completely different device. When the phone rings, it comes through the speakers of the car. It turns down the stereo and it uses the microphone inside. Where is the phone? I don't know. Because it's not the phone, the phoniness, so to speak, isn't in the microphone, it isn't in the speakers, it's not in the address book. It uses the same address book. And the minute I walk out, and I don't do anything, it's just by proximity, by position, it adapts its behavior. And there's some really interesting things about this that sort of say, so for example, if you are using the touchscreen, which is absolutely great when I'm here to work my phone, if you're using that while you're driving, you should use your license. You should lose your driver's license. I don't want you driving around my kids or my grandkids. I don't have grandkids, but if I did, I'm too young. Now, if you're not using speech while you're driving, and even then it's questionable, but you shouldn't be driving. On the other hand, having the same conversation because you're doing a business plan that you're about to present to Steve Ballmer, and you're doing it on the same phone exactly for the same meeting, but you're flying there instead of driving, and you're flying into San Jose Airport for the meeting. If you use speech on the airplane, you should lose your job, not your license. It's not about the technology. It's about the context, the social context. And if the phone can't use touch, speech, or pen, depending on what's necessary, or other things, then you've got a real problem. And so it's not about the technology, it's all about the context, and you need to understand these things, and these are all human values. Here's Kinect. Here's a kid, front, bam, playing a video game. It's got all this cool 3D imaging going on that lets them really get physically involved. I fly a lot. There's video games on the entertainment system on the seat back in front of me, right? Here's our eldest son, Adam. Notice I photoshopped, actually I didn't, I used Microsoft Digital Image Suite 2006, which by the way is still one of the coolest programs ever written by put up by Microsoft. I took the image from that very shot, put it, you know, pasted it in to the entertainment system. So imagine Adam, that's my son's, our son's name, he's playing the same game. He's got Kinect on the plane, and he's standing on the seat and the plane's landing, right? It's not about playing video games. The same person, same game, same technology, it's completely wrong there. You'll get thrown off the plane, and as well as get just really, when we that really was on a plane, and when I was photographing that, let's be very clear, the other people in the cabin were looking at us very, very strangely. He's strange anyhow. But the point I'm getting at is, Kinect, no matter how cool it is, it's terrible for that place. Even playing exactly the same game. We have to understand that stuff. And our systems have to adapt to the context in the same way the phone does in the car. One size does not fit all, even for a single user doing a single application. Because if that application is used in different contexts, we have to understand that stuff. All right. Here's Surface. Touch, vision, it's very cool. What's Surface made out of? Some cameras below shooting up with a camera. Projector, camera from below. What did Proust say? Look at the world through other eyes. Okay, I'm going to turn it upside down. Let's turn Surface on its head. Let's pull off all the garbage. And let's put the projector and the camera in our phone. My phone now is portable Surface. Instead of being this great big thing you can't carry, there's one out in the hall, I think. Try and pick it up. You can't. My mobile, I can. Because this camera can see the Surface in exactly the same way Surface can, the projection Surface, it becomes a touchscreen. Every projected image becomes a touchscreen. And it not necessarily, it's not just your touch, it's mine. Two of us can do it. And all of a sudden, the mobile phone, by viewing it from different eyes, and redefining what even a touch interface is. This most private, intimate, and personal of technologies that's with me all the time, almost, becomes the most ubiquitous form for social computing and social, this is social networking, for face-to-face, not remote. So now, I'm in a restaurant, I can just project down. So for example, I want to take your picture. This is great. Memories, right? There you are. Now, this is a camera with a projector. Unfortunately, it's a stupid one. So they haven't wired the camera to the projector. It works sequentially as opposed to together. But there is no reason that lens that took that picture in the first place couldn't be now correlating what it's seeing with what it's projecting, because it knows what it's projecting. It's got the image inside it, right? And then see that my finger wasn't part of what it's projecting, so it's something new, and therefore I could touch and interact and just brush and work like that. And it also means that I could be here, even this light. That's bright enough to see, isn't it? It's out of focus, but if it's a laser projector, it'll always be in focus, right? But now, we can be in a restaurant and I can just show you stuff on the table and you and I can interact with it together. And it might be a CRM system, by the way. Since November, this has been available for $400 on Amazon. I gave one to Steve Ballmer just so that he could actually show it and actually believe that I'm not, you know, nuts when I say this is possible to do. I've been working on this stuff since 2002. These projectors. I didn't have anything to do with this one. But by the way, if they are laser projectors, they're always in focus. So that even goes out of the way. So the point is that it completely redefines what do we think about, what is Surface? Surface isn't this table. It's a concept of combining vision with image, with optical recognition. So you can actually scan documents and objects and so on and so forth. All right, so we've walked around right out of time. And I just want to say, where does this bring us to what I'm supposed to be talking about, natural UI? What does it mean? Well, if I've done anything, I've sort of tried to stay narrow but drill down and show the diversity, even when you stick almost exclusively to touch and touch-related things, with a little bit of excursion to gesture, voice, and pen. And show the combinatorics and the details, gods and the details, means there's an incredibly rich space if we drill down. The problem is the space is so rich, how do you actually cover enough when you're on a deadline to ship a product? Well, first of all, you have research. That's what we're for. But also, if you understand the long nose, you have a plethora of examples that you can draw on that are already out there that most of your competitors and colleagues aren't even seeing if you have the other eyes. If you understand the long nose, you understand this notion of prospecting, then you only have to have one other thing that you need to understand. Natural is really simple. It's just as simple as nature, which actually isn't simple at all. Not for God, the people have to make it. Our job is to deal with complexity. But if we understand the nature of our customers and the environment, the whole social, physical, emotional ecosystem in which they function, their natural habitat, then if we have command of the details plus command of the technologies in terms of virtuosity and the technology as well as the things I'm talking about, we can in fact deliver them products that are worthy of their needs and things we can be proud of. And my sense is, without having the full range of concept and vision and approach and thought process, we're going to fail in that. My sense is, like these cameras and the things I've shown you, like that watch from 1984, by the way, I have four watches coming back here at the end of this talk while I've got some questions. They prove that I'm not setting the bar too high and that every one of us can do this if we have the right eyes. And with that, I'll say take some questions and say thank you very much. So, other questions? Yes.
What went wrong if it's taking 20 years to develop more commercial or widespread? What went wrong, or does it always take time?
Yeah, that's a really. So, the question was, what went wrong? Why does it take 20 years? So, first of all, this is one of the things about there has to be some benefit to getting old or older, right? Because it used to frustrate. Why isn't it obvious? Why isn't it just happening right now? Well, the reality is that none of these things. When you analyze, people talk about the iPhone as being successful because of multi-touch. It's not successful because of multi-touch. It's successful because of a whole range of things. Why did the smartphone happen in 2007 instead of 1993? Because that thing was a brick. And it was just the technologies weren't there. Why didn't that watch succeed? Well, because yes, the touch worked, but it just marginally worked, and you had to write the characters in a special way. It's not very reliable. But the thing is that things have changed, and that which failed before, if we understand why did these things fail, it's also why did things succeed? Why did the Palm Pilot kill Microsoft? I mean, at exactly the same time, Microsoft is getting clobbered for unfair trade practices and monopolistic things in terms of Office and these types of things and operating systems. Palm kicked Microsoft's butt in the PDA domain. We had Windows CE devices which were being clobbered by Palm at exactly the same time. Why? How could this little startup clobber, you know, this thing that apparently nobody can compete with because it's unfair? And the answer is not because it was small and only had four functions and stuff like that. It's because, and nobody will, I find an article that actually, here's my analysis, it succeeded because of hot sync. Because up until that point, all PDAs, most of them are pretty good. A lot of them are pretty good. But if you dropped them, There's an article in Rolling Stone where Robert Plant got off the toilet and his PDA was in his back pocket, went into the toilet, and he lost everything, right? Because there's no way to back it up. The same thing in your Filofax. Palm made it so that with one button push in less than a minute, any idiot could always have a photocopy of their entire life, just like that. And furthermore, to bootstrap and get it set up, you only had to hook it up once and all of your address book and all your calendar went in automatically, back and forth. It was bi-directional. Hot sync. Not touch, not graffiti, not at small size. All those things were essential, but they weren't sufficient. The chain, there were other things, companies that could do that. And it's understanding, it's trust, it was about trusting the technology, not about its function. That it, what was preventing people from making a commitment to this technology? It was fear. Fear of losing their data, fear that it would break. And you remove that fear, that reluctance to make the purchase decision, bingo, they took off. And now it's unimaginable not to have that. But that was the Palm innovation. That was the one. And even Jeff in his book doesn't talk about it in that way. I'm not even sure he understands that that was actually the really, in my view, that was the real win. And all I can say is that ask yourself for every product, what were the things in the ecosystem that held them back? Multi-touch for us, we didn't even, to be honest, that music application I was doing, that's why the multi-touch was a direct path to the iPhone, direct path through a company called Fingerworks from our work, and we were just making a drum. That's all I was trying to do. I was a musician. I didn't care about this stuff. I was just trying to make a drum that you could hit it and drag your hand across and have the damping change and change the pitch like you would with any hand drum. That's what we'd built multi-touch for in the first place. Graffiti in the Palm Pilot grew out of our work as well. That was just a way to do shorthand, enter music notation with a stylus. Direct path. And so the thing was is that all of the best ideas I've ever had came when I had a very specific target, a very specific thing that I was designing for as opposed to making general solutions. I never try to do general solutions. I go specific, and I go specific in different places, and then I step back and say, oh, there's some generalizations here. Let's draw across, and now let's, but don't unify until you've gone deep. But in different areas. This is my way of working. But it takes time. It's an ecosystem. Don't be embarrassed because it takes 20 years. Just don't start at the tip of the nose if you don't work at Microsoft Research. If you're in a product group, start 15 years down. Now you got 5 years to go through your development cycle and get it right by the time you hit it running. And then start, but look at the trends. And then take every example you can. Because other people, you got 15 years of experience of other people at other people's expense that you can learn from, if you do your analysis right. That's the message. You have 15 years of experience, and you still have 5 years lead time to be successful. Yeah. So I think that the question is it something in a corporate culture? Well, I think it's not in a corporate culture. It's in human nature because startups have the same problem as big corporations in this regard. To see and startups aren't any better at innovation. This is one of the biggest myths. See, you only see the startups that succeeded, and so I say, wow, every startup I know about is really successful, bringing ideas, and our company's hopeless. Well, what you don't see is the 95% of startups that fail, the 98% of startups that fail. Startups are no better than big corporations at innovation. I believe that. It's a reasonable thing. I mean, challenge that. If you actually look at the number of startups, talk to people who are venture capitalists. And so we got to stop hitting ourselves. You're supposed to fail, but get over it and get on with it. There's a great book that I'm reading right now that just came out. It's fantastic, and it's something about error. Somehow we'll find a way that it's in my bag. I'm just reading it now. But I have a Business Week column that's about this. You have to fail and fail all the time. Failure is not failure. Failure is education. Failure is fundamental to learning. My kids hated me. I was a terrible father. We'd go skiing. They come back and say, little daughter Katie, bless her heart, when she was listening, she had a little lisp. Bill, I had a great day skiing. I didn't fall down once a day. And I was the kind of jerk who would say, well, that's fine. I'm glad you had fun, but you didn't learn anything. So what do you mean? Because we didn't fall down. If you weren't falling down, you couldn't have been trying anything new. I was a horrible father. It's true. It's all about falling down. But my job as a good parent was to undertake her out not in Ontario icy snow, but in deep Whistler powder snow, something. That would be the fair thing. So you don't hurt yourself. That's how you cushion. Yeah. Yeah, this is a problem that happens all the time, and this is one of the biggest things. So let's be very clear. Dynamics is a kind of big piece of code. And to refactor it overnight, to be multi-threaded, so I can do two-handed stuff and have those parallel input plus multiple users, plus be collaborative over a distance, is even frightening to think about. Because you've got the huge amount invested in your customers, payrolls and other things that are dependent on you not screwing up the code. And how do you do that? And I'd argue the following. Most people think the problems with innovation is a lack of great ideas. I think that's nonsense. If I can't have a patentable idea every 2 hours, I don't deserve my job. Ideas from professionals should be a dime a dozen. Really good ideas, a dime a dozen. Stop treating ideas as precious. And so you're going to read Engadget and stuff like that. It drives me nuts. These people think that I'm a great genius. They do these envisionment things. They have these UIs that are like, I envisioned it, and so I had the idea, so I'm the great inventor. Give me a break. It's like artists who say, I thought about this piece of work. I'm a conceptual artist. No. The hard part isn't having the idea. The tricky part is, how do I get from here to there? How do I actually make it happen? And you know, they sort of say great ideas are 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. Well, that's a paraphrase of an Edison quote. But the key thing is, it actually, the most important part, there's about a 10-fold increase in return on investment for innovation on process than there is on innovation in product. And most people think are striving to innovate on some new product. What's the new concept? What's the new product? What's the new UI going to be? As opposed to innovation in the process and get us from here to there. That's why I wrote a book not about some great new idea, but rather about the sketching process that helps us accelerate how we can get there, to figure it out before we start investing time in writing code. Process, that's why sketch flow is important and things like that. And the other part is that this is the hard part. We're going to come like Microsoft. We're not a consumer electronics company. And how you evaluate innovation in a consumer electronics is completely different than you do in an enterprise, where somebody's got literally a $1 billion payroll dependent on you not making a mistake. Right? And so, A, there's a certain reason to have some caution and some due diligence in integration. The problem is you have to ask yourself, why did they buy the company in the first place if they couldn't see a way of how to get from here to there? And so there's these two parts. It's good to have the idea. Now, how do I get from here to there? And if I don't know the answer to that question, is it important that I want to get there? And don't say in the next product release, but in the next three product releases, maybe. What's a reasonable thing, and how do I start going? So the trick is this. I think about this in terms of fly fishing. And it's I just thought about this watching, that river runs through it, right? I cast over there because I think the fish are there. I reel in. That's the future. That's where I'm going to catch the fish. I reel in. I might catch some fish along the way. But when I reel in, I trace a trajectory through the water. And it comes out of my feet. That's today. That's where I am right now. I need a vision where I want to go. I might be able to make money here, there, there, and there. No matter how much I could make there, I shouldn't do that. It's a diversion because I've declared that's my vision. That's the direction I'm going. That's what I believe. And I darn well better have good reason for that, be able to rationalize that. So I should only cherry pick the things that are on that line, on that trajectory. And if I really want to pursue here, I should rethink whether I think whether the fish really are there or whether maybe there's a current in the water that makes my line come that way. Right? But all I'm trying to say is that without vision, without knowing where you're trying to go and why, every direction is the right way, but it also gives you Brownian noise. Right? It's just Brownian motion. And so we need vision. I'd like the world, and I want it now, but I can't have it. I'm mature enough to understand that. So how can I convince management and everyone in the organization get alignment? And that notion of how do you get alignment? How do you get the vision? How do you get everybody on the same page so we get there as fast as is reasonable and responsible given the nature of the customer and how we do it for a one-off product, which is a consumer product with a six-month release cycle, is completely different than a product that has 600 or 2,000 engineers and a 2 to 3 year release cycle. To compare those things and expect the same rate of innovation is just insane. But it says that we do have a 3 year release cycle that we need to spend way more time and really improve our processes so when we do invest those 3 years that we don't miss the boat and we really have thought that through. And that's where we really have room for improvement in our process. But we have to purge ourselves of Apple envy and understanding Apple better or our other competitors and learn from them. Because if we can't beat them, they deserve to win. They're easy to beat in our space with what we know. And by the way, I say that I don't want them to disappear. I believe I'm an athlete. I love competition. It helps everybody get better. And we'll push them better, and they'll push us, and the customer wins, and that's who should win. And it keeps us going. It's a great space. Anything else? Last question, yeah. So I'm going to come closer. Can you speak a little louder too? I'm not sure I understood the question, but what I heard was the scope of interaction techniques, technologies I talked about was rather narrow, and compared to the richness of things that where things are going, and I think if that's part of your comment, then I guilty as charged, because I wanted to just stay narrow in something within scope, and then. Say I've only talked, and so what I maybe should say a bit more clearly, I've only talked about a very small piece of the pie, and the pie is really big. But every other slice is that big. While everybody's focused on how to get touch right or gesture right and so on and so forth, I think that actually we're missing some of the most important problems. It's not about how any single gadget or any single device or any single application works. Whether you work for Microsoft, Google, or Apple, it doesn't matter. The bottom line is this. Going forward, nobody is going to judge your company and your company's products by how well any single product works. They're not even going to judge your products by how well they work in conjunction with your other products. It's how they're going to work within the larger social and technological ecosystem in which they appear. So, for example, that's why I used that car example. It is like my phone completely morphs into a different beast where I don't even know where the phone is. What is the essence of a phone when I go in the car? Because the car and every office is going to be the same way. Think of the car, the modern automobile, as a building, your home or your office. And the technology embedded in it as being sensor networks. A car is full of sensor networks. Your car is a building, right? It's got a roof, it's got doors, it's got walls, it's got an entertainment system, it's got a furnace, it's got all this other stuff, it's got seats. And it can sense everything. There's way more input than there is output within it on the computational side. The nature computation in a car is completely different than the nature computation that we're taught in computer science programs. It's not L or 1 parsers. It's distributed parallel real-time computing, distributed fail-safe, full of sensor networks, ambient intelligence. All these buzzwords are all there embedded in the architecture of vehicle today. And furthermore, there's the stuff that's embedded, and then the things you bring, like your MP3 player and your phone, all those things naturally, seamlessly integrate with it. And yet, with all our genius, here is a Microsoft smartphone. Here is a Microsoft Office product. I can't grab that slide. You can't use your phone to grab that image. You can't use your thing to point, use this touchpad as a pointer to that. The challenge going forward is how does, instead of one big general purpose glob, how do we make these smaller specialized devices have their own personality? So my camera knows it's a camera and not a supercomputer, but it has access to one through the cloud. How does it know what it is? Not have an identity crisis. My MP3 player know that it's not a camera. It might have a camera in it, but it's not my SLR. Each one has its personality. It does what it does. That's all it does. But when it comes close, like my phone and my car, to another technology, they can leverage each other and seamlessly work together. And so the trick for me is, how do you do... It's not about social computing. It's about, sure it is, but it's about social computing, about the society of appliances, not just the society of people. It's the society of appliances. What are the social conventions and social mores? So how this by proximity connects to here and lets me move that when I walk away, it has a different relationship. How do these things work? And how do you do that in a sense where because of security and protocols that we won't connect anything to anything? How will it be when I go to a bus shelter and the advertisement on the bus shelter is a Nike ad, and when I walk up to it with my smartphone, that I can just grab a window that pops up and get the bus schedule and then pull it into here, control it there, or just play a video game and then walk away without fear that I'm going to have the data compromised or security compromised on the street in public and different than my office? All those things. There's huge problems with security, interconnection, seamless interconnection. And it's not about how it works here. It's really important about proximity, right? So right now, everybody's, like, you're laughing, right? Because, and she's feeling really uncomfortable. Or maybe we're not. That's not bad. So it's great for me. But you notice proximity is one of the strongest social things. But anybody walking in this room knows I'm the speaker and you're not. They know that he's the cameraman and I'm not. And as soon as I bring these boundaries just by space, I change relationships. Our devices can't do that. By the way, this is a case where Bluetooth, supposedly an improvement over IR, has really interesting weaknesses, because in IR, I've got line of sight, so I know when I point with you with my Palm Pilot to send a card that he can't get it. With Bluetooth, I have no idea where the hell it's going or how far. Okay. Now, there's weaknesses, but how do we do that so that I can really have a secure thing, because I trust you, and therefore I trust your device? But then I have to know it's going to you alone, but I don't want to have all this stupid handshaking and coordination that just makes it so crazy I'll never do it. It has to be transparent somewhere when I get my car. I don't have to tell my car once, this is my phone, you're my car, now make it work. But in a rental car, I would never do it, right? How do you make it work in a rental car the same way? The minute I walk in a rental car, bam, my phone goes down and says, oh, you rented this car? Bingo. And I'll know that when I leave the car, it's a rental car, and I return the car, that it automatically gets rid of all of my data that it needed for my thing, right? Those are huge problems. And how do you do this pinch and zoom and these stupid little detail things? Who cares? That's not the problem. The problem isn't on these stupid interfaces. It's how do these things work together? Go to any company, Microsoft not alone, any company, and try and hook a laptop up to a projector in a conference room. And then try and video conference with somebody in Redmond. And I don't care what company you work for, no company in the world can do that, including Cisco, that sell all the telepresence stuff. Trust me, I know, okay? This is how bad we're doing. And yet collaboration and so on is a really important thing. The problems are huge, And the stuff I've talked about is just one small part of it. But the same things I'm talking about left and right-handedness in terms of motor sensory skills, you have exactly the same level of detail and fine granularity that you need to get right in terms of social computing and remote collaboration, these other things. It's just a different skill set that you have to understand. And that's why we need, that's why we have 1,000 people at Microsoft Research. Because it's a hard problem and it's a really broad domain. But on the one hand, if you have those kinds of problems, you should talk to us if you need some help. Because it is hard. So that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming, Bill.